Judges 17. And there was a man of Mount Ephraim, whose name was Micah. And he said unto his mother, The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from thee, about which thou cursedest, are and spakest of also in mine ears, Behold, the silver is with me. I took it. And his mother said, Blessed be thou of the Lord, my son. And when he had restored the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver unto the Lord from my hand for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. Now therefore I will restore it unto thee. Yet he restored the money unto his mother, and his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the founder, who made thereof a graven image and a molten image. And they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a house of gods, and made an ephod and a teraphim, and consecrated one of his sons, who became his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And there was a young man out of Bethlehem, Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed out of the city from Bethlehem, Judah, to sojourn, where he could find a place. And he came to Mount Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he sojourned. And Micah said unto him, Whence comest thou? And he said unto him, I am a Levite of Bethlehem, Judah, and I go to sojourn, where I may find a place. And Micah said unto him, Dwell with me, and be unto me a father and a priest, and I will give thee 10 shekels of silver by the year, and a suit of apparel, and thy victuals. So the Levite went in, and the Levite was content to dwell with this man, and the young man was unto him as one of his sons. Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest, and was in the house of Micah. Then said Micah, Now know I that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to my priest.
Okay, so what we're looking here today, looking at, is Judges 17, and as Jacob read for us, this is the beginning of apostasy, the first apostasy. And you see that in this chapter we are told how Micah, an Ephraimite, furnished himself with an image for his God, and with a Levite, such as one as he was, for his priest. Verses 1 through 6, here we have Micah and his mother quarreling. The son robs his mother, and the old woman was hoarding with long scraping and saving a great sum of money, 1,100 pieces of silver. It's likely she intended when she died to leave it to her son, but in the meantime it did her good to look upon it and to count over it. The young man had a family of children growing up, for he had one of an age to be a priest. So he knows where to find his mother's cash, thinks he has more need of it than she does, and cannot stay until she dies. So he takes it away privately for his own use. Though it is a fault in parents to withhold from their children that which is meat and lead to them into temptation to wish them in their graves, yet even this will by no means excuse the wickedness of those children that steal from their parents and think all their own that they can get from them, though by the most indirect methods. So the mother curses the son, and or whoever had taken her money, and it should seem she suspected her son. When she cursed, she spoke in his ears so loud, and with so much passion and vehemence, she made both his ears to tingle. Has anybody had that happen? See what mischief the love of money makes, how it destroys the duty and comfort of every relation. It was the love of money that made Micah so undutiful to his mother as to rob her and make her so unkind and void of natural affection to her son as to curse him as if he had had it and concealed it. Outward losses drive good people to their prayers, but bad people to their curses. This woman's silver was her god before it made her thither into a graven or molten image. Even the loss of it would not have put her in such passion as caused her quite to forget and break through all the laws of decency and piety. It's a very foolish thing for those that are provoked to throw the curses about as a madman that casteth firebrands, arrows, and death, since they know not, but they may light upon those that are most dear to them. Micah and his mother reconciled. The son was so terrified with his mother's curses that he restored the money. Though he had little grace as to take it, he had so much left as not to dare to keep it when his mother had sent a curse after it. He cannot believe his mother's money will do him any good without his mother's blessing, nor dares he deny the theft when he is charged with it, nor retain the money when it is demanded by the right owner. It is best not to do evil, but it is next best when it is done to undo it again by repentance, confession, and restitution. Let children be afraid of having the prayers of their parents against them, for though the curse causeless shall not come, yet that which is justly deserved may be justly feared, even though it is passionately and indecently uttered. So the mother was so pleased with her son's repentance that she recalled her curses and then turned them her prayers for her son's welfare. Blessed be thou, the Lord, of the Lord, my son, when those that have been guilty of a fault appear to be free and ingenuous in owning that they ought to be commended for their repentance. Rather than be condemned and upbraided for their fault, and then Micah and his mother agreed to turn their money into a god and set up idolatry in their family. And this seems to have been the first instance of the revolt of any Israelite from God and his instituted worship after the death of Joshua and the elders that outlived him, and is therefore particularly related. And though this was only the worship of the true God by an image against the second commandment, yet this opened the door to the worship of other gods. And we've seen this happen in different circumstances, like Balaam and the groves, against the first and great commandment. The mother's contrivance of this matter, when the silver was restored, she pretended she had dedicated it to the Lord. And either before it was stolen, and then she would have thought to be the reason why she was so much grieved at the loss of it, and put evil upon him that had taken it, because it was dedicated and therefore the accursed thing. Or after it was stolen, she had made a vow that if she could retrieve it, she would dedicate it to God. And then she would have the providence that so far favored her as to bring back to her hands to be an owning of her vow, as we talk about providence in our class, midweek class. And again, looking at this, we're looking at Micah's character and, you know, the whole family and seeing what's happening here. Come, she said to her son, the money is mine, but thou hast a mind to it. Let it be neither mine nor thine, but let us both agree to make it into an image for a religious use. Had she put it to a use that was indeed for the service and honor of God, this would have been a good way of accommodating the matter between them. But as it was, the project was wicked. Probably this woman is one of those that came out of Egypt and would have had such images made as she had seen there. And now that she had begun to dote, she called it remembrance, to remembrance the follies of her youth, and perhaps told her son that this way of worshiping God by images was to acknowledge the old religion. The son's compliance with her, it should seem, when she first proposed the thing, he stumbled at it, knowing what the second commandment was, for when she said she designed for her son to make an image of it, yet restored it to his mother, being not wanting to have a hand in making the image. And she gave it to the founder and had the thing done, blaming him perhaps for scrupling at it. When the images were made, Micah, by his mother's persuasion, was not only well reconciled to them, but greatly pleased and in love with them. So strangely bewitching was idolatry, and so much supported by traditions received from their parents. That was in 1 Peter 1 and 18. But observe how the old woman's covetousness prevailed, in part above her superstition. She had wholly dedicated the silver to make the graven and molten images, all the 1,100 pieces. But when it came to be done, she made less than a fifth part of it serve even 200 shekels. She thought that enough, and indeed it was too much to give for an image that is a teacher of lies. It had been devoted truly to the honor of God. Had it been, he would not thus have been put off with part of the price, but would have signified his resentment of the affront, as he did in the case of Ananias and Sapphira. So we observe, what was the corruption that was introduced? Going over this story, when I first saw it, I figured, you know, how much can I find out about what this? But there's so much behind it. It goes on and on. So with the corruption introduced, the man Micah had a house of gods, so the Septuagint, for so he thought it, as good as that at Shiloh, and better because he had his own and his own inventing and at its own disposal, for people love to have their religion under their girdle or to manage it as they please. A house of error, so the Chaldee, for really it was so. A deviation from the way of truth, an inlet to all deceit. Idolatry is a great cheat, and one of the worst of errors. That which he aimed at in the progress of his idolatry, whether he designed it at first or not, was to mimic and rival both God's oracles and his ordinances. His oracles, for he made teraphim, little images which he might advise with as there was occasion and receive information, directions, and predictions from. Just like what the Urim and Thummim were to the prince and people, that these teraphim should be to his family. Yet he could not think that the true God would own them or give answers by them, and therefore depend upon such demons as the heathen worshipped to inspire them and make them serviceable to him. This is also sounding like the churches around us with all the images and statues that they have and praying to all the time. So while the honor of Yahweh was pretended, yet his institution being relinquished, these Israelites unavoidably lapsed into downright idolatry and demon worship. His ordinances, some room or apartment in the house of Micah, was appointed for the temple or house of God. An ephod or holy garment was provided for the great priest or his priest to officiate in. This is just like one of us trying to do this and setting up our own place of worship in the wrong way. So he provided for his priest to officiate in imitation of those used at the tabernacle of God, and one of his sons he consecrated, probably the eldest, to be his priest. When he had set up a graven or molten image to represent the object of his worship, no marvel if a priest of his own getting and of his own making served to be the manager of it. There is no mention of any altar, sacrifice, or incense in honor of these silver gods, but having a priest, it is probable he had all these, unless we suppose that at first his gods were intended only to be advised with, not to be adored, like Laban's teraphim. But the beginning of idolatry, as of other sins, is like letting forth of water to break the dam, and you bring a deluge. Well, here it began, the idolatry, and it spread like a leprosy. And you would also observe that as 1,100 pieces of silver were here devoted to the making of an idol, which ruined religion, especially in the tribe of Dan, as we will presently find, which was Samson's tribe. 1,100 pieces of silver were given by each Philistine lord for the ruin of Samson. And what was the cause of this corruption? There was no king in Israel, no judge or sovereign prince to take cognizance of the setting up of these images, which doubtless the country about soon resorted to and to give orders for the destroying of them, none to convince Micah of his error and to restrain and punish him, to take this disease in time by which the spreading of the infection might have been happily prevented. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And then they soon did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. When they without a king to keep good order among them, God's house was forsaken, his priests were neglected, and all went to ruin among them. So we see what a mercy government is, and what reason there is that not only prayers and intercessions, but giving of thanks should be made for kings and all in authority. Nothing contributes more under God to the support of religion in the world than that due administration of these two great ordinances, magistrates and ministry. Verses 7 through 13. Here we have an account of Micah's furnishing himself with a Levite for his chaplain, and we'll check into this Levite further. Either thinking his son, because he is the heir of his estate, too good to officiate, or rather because not of God's tribe, not good enough to observe. What brought this Levite to Micah? By his mother's side was of the family of Judah, and lived at Bethlehem among the mother's relations, for that was not a Levite city. Or upon some other account, as a stranger or inmate, sojourned there. So verse 7, when he went to sojourn where he could find a place and his travels, came to the house of Micah in Mount Ephraim. So now verse 8, some think it was his unhappiness that he was under a necessity of removing, either because he was persecuted and abused, this is just supposition, or rather neglected and starved at Bethlehem. At Bethlehem, God made plentiful provision for the Levites, but the people withheld their dues, did not help them into the possession of other cities assigned to them, so that they were reduced to straits, and no care was taken for their relief. Israel's forsaking God began forsaking the Levites, which therefore they are warned against in Deuteronomy 12 and 19. It's a sign that religion is going to decay when good ministers are neglected and at a loss for a livelihood. It seems rather to have been his fault in folly that he loved to wander. He threw himself out where he was and forfeited the respect of his friends, and having a roving head, would go to seek his fortune, as we say. We cannot conceive that things had yet come to such a pass among them that a Levite should be poor unless it was his own fault. All those are fit to be pitied that would fix but may not, so those are fit to be punished that may fix but will not. Unsettledness being, one would think, a constant uneasiness. It's strange that any Israelite, especially any Levite, should affect it. What bargain Micah made with him, had he not been well enough content with his son for the priest, he would have gone or sent abroad to inquire out of a Levite. But now he only takes hold of one that drops into his hands, which showed that he had no great zeal in the matter. It's probable that this rambling Levite had heard in the country of Micah's house of gods, and he had graven and molten images, which if he had anything of the spirit of Levite in him would have brought him to reprove Micah under his idolatry, to tell how directly contrary it was to the law of God, and how it would bring the judgments of God upon him. But instead of this, like a base, degenerate branch of that sacred tribe, He goes to offer a service with, "Have you any work for a Levite? For I am out of business and go to sojourn where I may find a place." All he aimed at was to get bread, not to do good. So Micah talks him into his family, or brings him in, and promises him good preferment, "Be unto me a father and a priest, though a young man, and taken up at the door yet. If he be, take him for a priest, he will respect him as a father, so far as he is from settling down among the servants, or among his servants. He asks not for his credentials, takes no time to inquire how he behaved in the place of his last settlement, considers not whether, though he was a Levite, yet he might not be of such a bad character as to be a plague and scandal to his family, but thinks though he should never be so great a person, he might serve for a priest to a graven image like Jeroboam's priest of the lowest of the people. No marvel if those that who can make anything serve for a god can also make anything serve for a priest." This is something else too to think about when we have people coming into our ecclesias, and to make sure that they have proper credentials coming for another ecclesia. So a tolerable maintenance. He will allow him meat and drink and clothes. So the word is in the margin, a better and a worse, one for every day's wear, and one for holy days, and 10 shekels, about 25 shillings a year for spending money. A poor salary in comparison of what God provided for the Levites that behaved well. But those that forsake God's service will never better themselves, nor find a better master. The ministry is the best calling, but the worst trade in the world. The Levite settlement with him in verse 11. He was content to dwell with a man, though his work was superstitious and his wages were scandalous. He objected against neither, but thought himself happy that he had lighted on so good a deal in the house of Micah, thinking himself holier than any of his neighbors, presumed to consecrate this Levite. As if his building, furnishing, and endowing this chapel authorized him not only to appoint the person that should officiate there, but to confer those orders upon him which he had no right to give or the others to receive. And now he shows him respect as a father and tenderness as a son, and is willing thus to make up the deficiency of the coin he gave him. And Micah's satisfaction in this: "Now know I that the Lord will do me good, that is, he hoped that his new establishment would gain reputation among his neighbors, which would turn to his advantage, or he would share it in the profit of his altar. Or rather, it was a sign of God's favor to him, and his image is that he had so opportunely sent a Levite to his door." Now here he's thinking this is providence. "Thus those who please themselves with their own delusions, if providence unexpectedly bring anything to their hands that further them in their evil way, are too apt to infer that God is pleased with them." We can look at that many different ways. He thought now that the error of his priesthood was amended and all was well, though he still retained his graven and molten image. Note, many deceive themselves into a good opinion of their state by a partial reformation. They think they are as good as they should be because in some one particular instance, they are not so bad as they have been, as if the correcting of one fault would atone for the persisting in all the rest. He thought of making a Levite into a priest was a very meritorious act in his mind, which really was presumptuous and very provoking to God. Men's pride and ignorance and self-flattery will undertake not only to justify, but magnify and sanctify the most daring impieties and invasions upon the divine prerogatives. With much reason might Micah have said, "Now may I fear that God will curse me, because I have debauched one of his own tribe and drawn him into the worship of a graven image. Yet for this he hopes God will do him good. He thought that having a Levite in the house with him would, of course, entitle him to divine favor. Carnal hearts are apt to build too much upon their external privileges and to conclude that God will certainly do them good because they are born of godly parents and dwell in praying families and are linked to society with those that are very good and sit under a lively ministry. Whereas all this is but like having a Levite to be their priest, which amounts to no security at all that Yahweh will do them good unless they be good themselves and make a good use of these advantages. So now we're going to find out who the Levite was. Levite was the grandson of Moses. I researched this, and this is the story of the first apostasy, as we said. The name of Moses stands out in Israel's history as that of the man who welded 12 unorganized tribes into a nation, brought that nation into covenant relationship with God, and through a long life stood firmly in his allegiance to the God of Israel and carried the nation with him in that allegiance. Israel never forgot him. And 1,400 years later, in the day of Christ, the words and commands of Moses were still regarded as law. No greater man had ever lived or would ever live, said every pious man of Israel. There arose not a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. It's Deuteronomy 34 and 10. This is the ancient chronicler who closed the story of Moses' life. He was a mighty man and for the righteous of God, righteousness. Set your hearts unto all the words which I testify among you this day, was his final exhortation to the nation just before his death, which you'll command to your children to observe to do all the words of this law. It is not a vain thing for you, because it is your life, and through this thing you shall prolong your days in the land. All the greater tragedy, therefore, that Moses' own grandson and his descendants for six centuries were apostates from the worship of God, serving an idol altar throughout the entire time of Israel's occupancy of the land. Moses had two sons, Gershom and Eliezer, both born to him before the Exodus, during the period of his exile in Midian. One son at least was still a child at the time of the Exodus, and they both entered the promised land. Neither of them appear to have inherited the outstanding characteristics of their celebrated father, and they seem to have been undistinguished members of the Levites, an office theirs by right of descent from Moses. And they probably served as such in some community in Israel. They are not mentioned in historical narratives, and it is evident that no particular honor was paid them in respect of their relationship to the great deliverer of the nation. So in the early days, we read of the men who rose up to defend and lead the people struggling to consolidate their hold on the land. We have Joshua, Caleb, Othniel, Ehud, but not Gershom or Eliezer. The mantle of Moses did not fall on his sons. It passed to others. Four centuries later, in the days of David, there was a brief reminder of these two. David, forbidden by God to build a temple, was nevertheless commanded to erect an altar to the Lord in Jerusalem. This he did on the summit of Mount Moriah, where Solomon's temple afterwards stood. To this house of the Lord, as David termed it, he gathered all the sacred treasures, spoils of war, dedicated to the Lord, and so on, and placed them under the supervision of Shebuel, descendant of Gershom, and Shelomith, descendant of Eliezer. A few scattered allusions in the Chronicles tell us how much, this much, preserve a few names, and that's all. These two were evidently men of God and honored with a share in the sacred duties. The darker side of this picture is displayed in the story of one other member of the family, Jonathan, the son of Gershom, and therefore grandson of Moses. Jonathan, born in the land in the very early days of the settlement, occupied a very minor office as a Levite attached to the tribe of Judah in Bethlehem in Judges 18. Apparently discontented with his lot, he made his way northward into territory of the tribe of Ephraim, seeking to better himself, as we might say. There he encountered an Ephraimite named Micah, who himself, infected with the prevalent idolatry of Canaan, had made himself idols, graven images, and set them up in his house. He invited Jonathan to enter his service as a kind of domestic priest, to attend upon idols and conduct religious observances on behalf of the family. And as we saw before, the terms were board and lodging, necessary officiating robes, and 10 silver shekels per year, which, since ordinary laborers' wages at the time ranged between 30 and 50 a year, was not a princely sum for a grandson of Moses the Conqueror. But he accepted it and entered upon his duties as apostate priest to an idolater. That really makes you think about it. The depth of ignorance into which Israelites like Micah had fallen is well illustrated by his comment upon the situation. And as we see, verse 13 in the English, "Now I know that Yahweh will prosper me because I have a Levite as a priest." So his complacency was rudely disturbed. A roving party of men from the tribe of Dan, migrating northward to seek more suitable territory for themselves, came upon Micah's house. So we see how this is getting worse and worse. And they found the idol installation complete with priests. Heedless of any rights Micah may have had in the matter, they took forcible possession of the idols and made a proposition to Jonathan. "It is better for these," they suggested, "to be a priest unto the house of one man. Is it better? Or that thou be a priest unto a tribe and family in Israel." So Jonathan saw the point and accepted the offer. He journeyed with them to the north, where they found a fertile country inhabited with only a peaceful and defenseless people, whom they unceremoniously slaughtered and established themselves in their place. So it was that Jonathan, the grandson of Moses, became the first high priest of the first organized system of idolatry to be established in Israel. There in the town of Dan, center of the northern territory of the tribe of Dan, most northerly point of the land of Israel, and not far from modern Damascus. He administered the ceremonies of a pagan faith, he and his sons after him, 700 years until the Assyrians came and took Israel into captivity. During all that time, these sons of Moses stood for all that their illustrious forebearer had so consistently and sternly condemned. The story is told in the 17th and 18th chapters of Judges. Like I said, when you look further into this, this really goes on and on. It must have taken place during the first century in the land. At the same time that Jonathan was leaving Bethlehem for a life of infamy in the north, Ruth the Moabitess was coming into Bethlehem to yield her life and devotion to Israel's God, joining an association with Boaz, the God-fearing Israelite, to forge another link and line that led to Christ, the greater prophet of whom Moses spoke. So the line of Jonathan ended in captivity and ruin and is now lost in obscurity. That of Ruth and Boaz is immortalized by the event which happened later at Bethlehem when the angels sang, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace and goodwill towards men." So the story was set down faithfully in the book of Judges, but in later manuscripts, the transcribers were reluctant to perpetuate the association of their great lawgiver's name with that of his apostate grandson, added the letter N to his name in Judges 18 and 30, making it Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, instead of Moses. This is the AV rendering. In the Hebrew text, the N is above the line, indicating that the original reading is Moses. Most modern translations, including the RSV and NEB, render it Moses. Four centuries later, Jeroboam, the first king of the 10 tribes, installed two golden calves as objects of worship, one at Bethel and the other at Dan. It's 1 Kings 12. At Bethel, he created an order of non-Levite priests. And of Dan, nothing is said. And it's obvious on the strength of Judges 18 that the sons of Jonathan continued to serve that sanctuary with the golden calf added to their original idols. Jehu, another two centuries on, destroyed Baal worship out of Israel, but left the golden calves and their worship untouched. And this is for a definite reason. These golden calves, like their prototype at the time of Sinai, were visible emblems of God of Israel. Oftentimes in the Old Testament, God was likened to the wild ox on account of its strength and irresistible power. Heedless of the commandment against making graven images of God and bowing down and worshiping images, these golden calves, which were likenesses of the wild ox, were set up in the sight of Israel, so that they can worship God in the same way as other nations worship their gods. Before a visible object made according to their own ideas. Hence Jehu, whose object was to destroy idol worship and preserve the worship of Yahweh, in his ignorance left the golden calves intact. And the result was that Bethel and Dan remained centers of idolatry throughout the whole of Israel's national existence. So you see how bad this really got. Ending only with the great captivities which cured Israel of that particular sin for all time. In much of their idolatry, the Israelites believed that they were worshiping the true God, the one whom Moses had revealed to them. But all the time they were worshiping false conceptions of God. And the final analysis of all idolatry comes down to that. Christians, Jews, and Muslims worship and serve the same God, but under so widely different views of his character and attributes that there can be little or no reconciliation. Christians in their various outlooks see God sometimes like Moloch, demanding human sacrifice by fire for his appeasement. Sometimes like Baal, the impersonal force of nature to which man is subject. Sometimes like Ashtaroth, without thought of higher things, and sometimes like the Hebrew wild ox, merciless to his enemies and a fierce partisan to his own people. All these false gods are found amongst us today, even with communities of Christians. So many have failed to realize the depth of meaning in Jesus' words to the woman at the well: they that worship God must worship him in spirit and in truth. Israel was forbidden to make graven images of God, and we in our own minds are apt to set up graven images, and like Jonathan, the grandson of Moses, worship them under the impression that we are worshiping the God of our fathers, when in reality, we're doing nothing of the sort. The Apostle John was aware of that when he said, "Little children, keep yourselves from idols." And then only in constant heed to the words of Jesus, a realization of our own union through him with the Father, he tells us, can we know God or really know him? And we know that the Son of God has come, and he hath given us an understanding that we may know him that is true, and we are in him that is true, even in his Son, Jesus Christ, the true God and eternal life.